Scott Atlas, he came out with a book. It's called A Plague Upon Our House. And I'm obviously not going to read the whole book on the air. And there's a lot to it. Now, I'm going to give a little caveat, okay? I recommend everybody gets this book. And the reason I recommend that is because he's in a perfect position to speak about this issue in a way that, as long as someone has two or three brain cells and can walk and chew gum at the same time, he'll come off as a measured person. And I'll give you an example. In the opening of his book, you know, he thinks that the vaccinations are good for vulnerable people. Okay? So take that debate aside. A lot of people get really nervous when, you know, you think that all vaccinations are bad. You know, that makes them, like, they get a little tick in them, like, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer. It's important that you have somebody who knows how to speak their language. But that's not the focus of his book at all. But that's just something that you find there. I think that this is the kind of book, you know, especially as things persist, this is the kind of book that you should give someone. After you've gone to shop.mikechurch.com and you've bought them a Founders Pass Premium membership, this is the kind of book that you can say, listen, this is a guy, he's a professor, you know, Hoover Institution, whatever. Read this book. He was there, and this will tell you a lot. People like to read those things. You know, I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. I got a couple books on there about the Clintons and about Obama. You know, one's called Hell to Pay. One's called Impeachable Offenses. Maybe you've heard them before. We're from Regnery Press, I think. And those are the kind of books that, you know, people will read them out of interest. Even people who are, you know, kind of centrist or liberal, they kind of like to just hear the gossip. Okay, they like to hear about the inner workings of the personalities. This is why they like to follow the royal family. They couldn't give a dang about monarchy, but they like what it looks like when it's on PBS specials. This book offers that angle, but he throws in there amazing information. One of the reasons why I think this book is going to be sort of a magnum opus as far as the whole COVID crap is concerned is because it's got a ton of data and literature, data and research from all the literature put into nice segments for you. So if you have this book, you know, you're looking around the internet and like, it's Google, you know, I use Google and DuckDuckGo. They both have pros and cons. DuckDuckGo is clearly better for finding things that Google wants to censor. But when somebody says, you know, what about this? And you try to give them information, you're like, oh, I got to find this tab. I got to look at my history. It's not easy to do all the time because there's just so much information coming out over and over and over again. This book makes all the arguments that you've wanted to make to your family members about this, and you can hand it to, I think, anybody. Some amazing quotes in here, and he says, the management of this pandemic, he misspelled it though. He has the same problem as Jeffrey Tucker. He spells pandemic without an L. I'll let it slide. The management of this pandemic has left a stain on many of America's once noble institutions, including our elite universities, research institutes, and journals, and public health agencies. Earning it back will not be easy. Trust in government. Almost all governors have made entirely arbitrary distinctions. Even if one believed in the health benefits of these diktats, they were handed down with shocking disregard for the potential damages and deaths. In addition to seeing convincing data to justify such measures in the future, the citizenry must be convinced that rules apply to everyone. When elected officials are caught enjoying indoor dining with lobbyists or public health leaders ignore their own restrictions on family gatherings, they undermine the moral legitimacy necessary for voluntary compliance. That puts the rule of law and future emergencies at risk. Trust in public health leadership. There has been a repeated erratic discussion coming from the public health officials on masks. America's leading voice of public health issued a number of statements over a period of months that were in direct conflict with each other and with the data. And he still fails to recognize the most compelling studies. This is talking about Fauci. On testing, the CDC put up a guideline, then changed it, then took it down, then put up back something close to the original. There was no science to prompt those changes. The most visible face of public health praised for Northeast U.S. states with the highest rate of fatalities for following his guidance, despite their deadly performance. We also saw statements and actions from our top health and medical agencies that undermine trust in vaccines and potential treatments, an extremely important part of saving lives in the next pandemic. Trust in science. The pandemic exposed grave problems with the essential functioning of science, research, and debate. Elite research universities, public health agencies, and top scientific journals quickly fell in line with herd thinking about the plandemic. Instead of open and free discourse to seek the scientific truths underlying urgently needed solutions, we have seen silencing, censoring, and slandering of scientists whose interpretations differed from the desired narrative. Prestigious journals are now openly contaminated with politics. Academia had the research community dominated by a single viewpoint, actively engage in intimidation and false declarations of consensus, as well as through the abuse of peer review system. That intolerance has fostered a climate of fear and inhibited other scientists and health experts from contributing to the discussion, effectively introducing self-censorship. This dangerous trend threatens the free exchange of ideas essential to democracy. He goes on too about the trust of fellow citizens. This is important. Policymakers, in concert with the elite class, inflicted great harm by undermining fundamental trust in our fellow citizens. Elites in the media have made quote-unquote freedom a selfish idea and politicized dissent on the efficacy of masks or various potential treatments. Restrictions on liberty were also destructive by inflaming class distinctions with their differential impact, exposing essential workers, sacrificing low-income families and kids, destroying single-parent homes, and eviscerating small businesses. While at the same time large companies were bailed out, elites worked from home with barely an interruption, and the ultra-rich got richer, leveraging their bully pulpit to demonize and cancel those who challenged their preferred policy options. This book is written with several purposes in mind. First, it will serve as an important part of the historical record on the greatest healthcare crisis of the past century, the pandemic and its management. The four-month period during my service as advisor to the President of the United States will provide a candid perspective on how our leaders functioned in this crisis without the distorting lenses of the media and politics. Second, we'll clarify the facts underlying the plandemic. Free from the filter of government bureaucrats, academics, and scientists with political and other biases. Third, it will expose profound issues in our society that could interfere with our stability to address, our ability, excuse me, to address future crises and threatened the very principle of freedom and order that we often take for granted and that the rest of the world depends on. The reader should feel confident of two certainties. One is that every word in this book, every event described, every statement quoted is absolutely true. The second is that several people described in this book will vehemently deny its truth. That's good. That is expected not only because they will have been exposed in the light of day beyond the protection of their media allies, but also because we have already witnessed their behavior with regard to truth. We should know who to trust by now. Now, that's just part of the introduction. There's so much in this book. He asks a series of questions that he answers in it. Some of them, for example, is, you know, we hear about these scientists behind. He goes, who were the scientists? Where were the economists? Where were the pediatricians and psychologists? Where were the teachers and university leaders? Where were the investigative journalists? Where were the constitutional lawyers? Where were the human rights advocates? Where were the ethicists? Where were the independent Americans? These are all questions we've been scratching our head about. You know, we don't know in some ways how we got here. He doesn't necessarily give, you know, here's why it happened because I found all the, you know, I did the whole Glenn Beck chalk talk thing and I found exactly what happened. Obviously, there's only so much that he can answer. But one of the things that I find fascinating about this book and what Dr. Atlas has been saying is that the people who work for public health, many of them are not that smart. They're not intelligent. There's been this idea inherent in this whole ethos surrounding academia and science and medicine for a long time, that these, you know, so-called scientists have some sort of special knowledge. They went to science school, don't you know? Well, people need to realize a lot of these people who have these scientific degrees, they went to school when they were 18 years old. They got drunk a lot. They had hangovers. They did drugs. They passed their degrees by cramming and complaining to their professors. They got a 78. And they found their way into some master's program that they did online. And now they have a master's of public health. I can't tell you how many engineers I knew in university who were dumber than my desk as far as their ability to make decisions in life. But like almost like a Rain Man tick, they could just sort of pick up these skills and they were able to do some mathematics and figure out a graphing calculator. And, you know, they had their reasons. They wanted to be rich or their dad was an engineer or something. And they took a bunch of Adderall and, you know, study drugs. And they got drunk all the time and they finished it. I would never trust them to ever do anything responsible, ever. But they are credentialed and they make $150,000 a year and whatever, whatever. You do not have to be smart to be a scientist. People need to understand that. You do not even have to be that, I'm sorry, but you don't have to be that smart to be a doctor. I knew a guy who did deliveries. He was a delivery driver for this, I don't know what an equivalent in the States would be, but it's one of those leasing, you can lease furniture and lease appliances and things, and you spend $100 a month and you get your home entertainment set or something. You know, I'm not judging, people make different economic decisions, but if you're making $200,000 a year, and you're leasing furniture, you're probably not very good with money. And he said that the majority of his clients were doctors. And there was a place in the city I grew up in called Pill Hill. It was a beautiful area where all these mansions, where all these doctors lived. These places were filled with double-income households, two doctors married, one kid, and four dogs. And they would be renting furniture because they were on credit for everything.